For more information, visit futurebased.org.
It's the Future Based podcast from the series Beyond Human Relations with your host Annika van den Boven. In this fourth podcast of the series, I'm going into conversation with Noam Jungrakson. Noam Jungrakson is a designer. Their focus lies on creating myths in well-designed fiction through various mediums, mostly in order to open up political discussions about underrepresentation. Their projects differ from books only readable for bets, to sex toys and gendered cables. Next to that, Noam refuses to define their gender as exclusively male or female. In other words, Noam socially and culturally refuses to be either male or female. They therefore refuse every norm of gender binary. Their identity as a queer person of color is one of their exes in their design practices. I'm talking today to Noam because of their daring and unexpected projects and in order to find out what ideas actually lie behind them. So, hi, Noam.
Hello, Annika.
Hi, how are you doing? And what mainly fills your thoughts this week?
Well, I'm doing okay. I very abruptly started living with two cats these days.
Okay, how come?
Yeah, I just met somebody in Brussels who is already a mother of two cats, and I started living with that person. So, somehow gained like three multi-species
husbands. It's very crowded.
I'm also reading a book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, which I find as an amazing publication. I'm almost at the last chapter at the moment. Lastly, I recently started a new project which introduces freshwater eels. I wouldn't call it protagonist as like a main driver of the story. So I'm also reading a lot about eels, how they procreate, how they travel, how they go through metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So far, none of the humans has observed eels reproducing. We don't know yet how they have sex.
So where did how did you come up with the topic eels? Where did you find it?
You know, it's also considered as like a very important food source, especially in South Korea and Japan. Mm. And I discovered a big Asian supermarket next to my house, and they had frozen marinated eel imported from Japan. So I find it very familiar because I was growing up in that context as like a fancy Christmas. Yeah, it's considered as a very prestigious food, by the way. So as like a fancy Christmas dinner, I bought the frozen eel, and I made myself and my partner like nice eel dish. Yeah, I mean, I think we're just amazed by the fact that we're, you know, eating a frozen fish that is imported from the, you know, from the other side of the planet. And we just Googled about, like, you know, what these fishes look like. And then just randomly discovered that nobody has observed how eel have sex yet. So that's how everything started. It's very arbitrary.
That's a funny ending of a Christmas meal.
Yes, indeed.
And what is your idea on what your project?
Right? Well, in the beginning, I was fascinated by the fact that we, you know, the modern civilization is always eager to, you know, identify things, make things clear, like to be rational, to be intelligent, to be informative. And I think these fish, especially the sexual behavior of these fish, are exactly at the counterpart of our modern ideology, which makes them extremely queer. Mm-hmm. In the sense that if you search on Google like how do gay people have sex, like there are like so many dumb questions on like Quora, like questioning like how do they have sex if they're lesbian, how do they have sex if they're like bisexual or trans. People have been asking the same question like since Aristotle, and also I think Nietzsche. They all questioned about how eels have sex.
Really?
Yeah, but they never reached a proper conclusion. So in a way, like we are like both eels and you know, queer people are, I don't know, objectified. Mm. as like a topic of curiosity that the, you know, normative people have to identify.
Ooh, interesting topic. I'm curious what you're going to do with it. You already mentioned that you're from South Korea. What made you decide to study design in the Netherlands?
Well, I wanted to study design. Yeah, I was considering the Netherlands as an appealing option because of, I think I was pretty much fascinated by the, you know, quote unquote, Dutch design of the early 2000s. Yes. And yeah, I think to look back, I think it was a very great decision to make. You know, the Dutch design industry is like the most like perfectly functioning, the most heavenly place for an individual designer to work in. But compared to the, you know, other design context, I think I really appreciate the non-conforming discussions that are happening in the Dutch design industry.
How did your interest in design grow? Why do you think this is the field that you want to be in?
Well, before choosing design as my field, I was surprisingly a science student. Mm-hmm. Especially back in South Korean context, there are really like specialized boarding schools that are for the students that are really like interested in science and technology. I was a student of that kind of school. And I was mainly interested in biology back then. I think I became a biologist, I think. I think it was very natural direction to grow in the design that doesn't only involve humans. The experience that I had in that context was really for me to be more comfortable with the interspecies issue when I'm dealing with design.
Really relevant background in biology and maybe the confrontation even in South Korea with you're not being fully accepted as you wished, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think by being a queer person, I was more or less an alien, which made me quite, first of all, tolerant of being a non-European in Europe. At the same time, to be able to appropriate the status in my own design practices.
How do you actually take your refusal of gender norms?
I think the sole fact that I'm a queer person of color doesn't automatically make my works queer. I think there can be also really straight or really white design that are produced. And also I think in the other way around, I also believe that queer designs that are queer can be also produced from the people that doesn't necessarily identify as queer. However, and I think in my case, it's more about the perspective that I embody as a queer person of color. For instance, the BAT project, Becoming a BAT Embodying COVID-19 project, that we'll probably talk about later, started by watching a very random video of Bear Grylls, who is an adventurer who was hunting bats in jungle. And I think because of the really like niche perspective that I have due to my political condition, that made me empathize about the bats, not the protagonist of the video. I think once you are in a like legitimate or normative status, then it really requires extra effort for them to perceive what's beyond that border. Because I'm the person who kind of came from the outside of the border, I would say. I think it kind of gave me perspective to be more eager to look beyond that borders.
Mm-hmm. I read on your website as well that you Your goal is to create myths for the underrepresented, and it feels like because of how the way you feel your life is not fitting into given categories, you kind of feel more compassion for those who are in the same position as well. And that maybe makes you even more creative in breaking down certain categories or taking it with you in your work. And that brings me to a question I wrote down for you about the underrepresented you place very central in your work. How do you define your definition of these underrepresented? How broad is this concept?
I think there isn't really a homogeneous standard which determines if one is more represented or not. I relate this to the term, the intersectionality that we use, that our presentation is on the intersection of, various political situations that we are in. Like, it can be class, it can be species, it can be, ethnicity, it can be gender, and they are intertwined in a very complicated way. What I meant by underrepresented in the introduction of my website was about that like holistic degree of far you are from a certain privilege, I would say.
And in that way, maybe your view on the underrepresented is more valuable. You could even see it as a queer view on what underrepresentation means or not. Where you also mentioned that your work may even be queer biased. By that term, I was so surprised because I thought, okay, queer is something non-defined, but mm-hmm. being queer biased is having a kind of lens that gives you a definition. So how do you experience a queer bias?
I believe that we are all biased in various ways. And I think what can be the most problematic thing is not to acknowledge that we are biased. Like, I've never seen a racist or a sexist who believes that they are that they are, racist or sexist. Mm. But I think the danger comes from, having a firm belief. And in that regard, yeah, I think we should acknowledge our own biases. And I use the expression queer bias in the sense that living in the world that is already, like, pretty much against queer, non-anti-queer biased world. And I think in order to survive in the world that is binary biased, I think I need a special lens to critically, observe how the world is constructed in a binary way.
Yeah. So maybe to construct and deconstruct at the same time.
Exactly.
What do you encounter by maybe using your queer view in work? How do people react to that?
I think it's quite difficult to boil down all the reactions that I gain from presenting my work in like one cohesive response.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's so diverse. Also in the sense that, people perceive a certain artwork in so many different degrees of depth. Like, some are only fascinated by the visuals, not giving a glimpse to the text, whereas like someone like you like go through everything that I published. But I think in many cases, I think what I regard as the biggest compliment is sort of those kind of uncanny feeling that one may perceive when they're, they realize how absurd the norms that they've been carrying with.
Yeah, and as you just said, it might be hard to get a cohesive answer because you do so many different projects. You put them together all in DEACT magazine, which
yes.
is online magazine, but also published on paper, right? In five cities internationally.
Yes, I think I have to make clear that, like, by saying that, it almost sounds as if I'm like running a media agency or something by calling it a magazine, but it's purely independent makeshift initiative that I've been carrying out all by myself. Mm. And the only reason that it can be called a magazine is because it's a form of periodic publication. Yeah, I really had like a strong ambition toward producing something that is relevant in a really like small scale very frequently. Also what I so since 2019 I've been like making like what I call a magazine that only serves as a very self-sustaining channel for what I find valid. Since 2020, which was the year of COVID-19 as well, I reformatted the monthly publication format that I was sticking to into a quarterly publication, which from that moment also became printed.
I can imagine that the editing and the putting the medium out there is a whole other story than just creating the design, and takes a lot of effort. I'm glad you're doing it. It's very visually pleasing on the website. Yeah, really. It's a good thing to have a look at. And you'd mentioned the Gendered Cable Manifesto. Maybe you could explain shortly what kind of project that was for.
Yeah, so it's a project that started from a critical observation that I had on the electric cables, that the terminology they're being called are gendered. So depending on if they are if they're plugged in or if another cable is plugged into itself, they are called male or female, which is, I don't know, I cannot even describe how severely problematic this is. that it reduces the concept of gender, which is way more nuanced than that, into if you penetrate or if you're penetrated, which I of course entirely disagree with. So I've been looking into that phenomena and researching about how the world of cable functions, which is essentially constructing the whole digital infrastructure that we're maybe entirely relying on in the time of lockdown and Zoom meetings. And what I discovered was that even though the terms are coined in a horribly binary way, I could still observe a few queer instances that creates very funky or kinky consequences if it's directly applied to humans. For instance, if you see how the nature of electric cables, they're essentially, they are instruments of connecting one point to the others, and therefore they always have more than one connectors, more than one genitalia every cable has, which makes, even though they are individual genitalia, individual connectors are binarily gendered. By having more than ones of those at the same time, it makes the gender of the cable itself very ambiguous. If you think about a human being with one quote-unquote male genitalia and like maybe three other quote-unquote female genitalia. So that's the first point that I discovered about the queerness of the cables.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, also because they're supposed to make connections, they're always having more than one, when they're in function, they always have more than one sexual connections, sexual intercourses at the same time, if all the connectors are plugged.
Mm-hmm.
Which, just directly challenges the monogamous idea that we have about intimacy. So in a way, the cables that, constructs a digital apparatuses that we're living upon, like Facebook or even like your iPhone, which consists of numerous like tiny electric cables. If you see it from the perspective of sexual intercourse, they're forming an orgy. So yeah, that's the conclusion that I had. Like, if we learn how their sexual intercourses are happening, at least gives some contingencies that we can overcome our normative idea about genitalia, sex, intimacy. So yeah, I wrote manifesto text that kind of introduces what I just described in more structural way. And I also, as a designer, I visualized how would human sexual intercourse would take place if we look after the ways that electric cables have sex. And also at the same time, what kind of sexual infrastructure would it require? For instance, if you see the love hotels, in reality, they consist of numerous, rooms for couples that is firmly based on monogamy, of course. But if we supposed that we are forming sexual relationships like the electric cables, then another interesting question is like, how would a love hotel would look like? Or how would a sex toy would look like? How would a sex chair would look like? And yeah, I like speculatively designed how those might be by having a premise of people having sex like electric cables.
Yeah, I really appreciate how you're not afraid to also get a very crazy idea out there, and your queer lens definitely brings a new view to this. And I think this brings about it is brought about political debates to the people you showed it. Is your goal with your work always to create a critical debate?
I'm not sure if I'm always successful at it, but I think I at least aim to. And in that regards, I think proposing something as hilarious as this is a great tool that I've been relying on.
Mm-hmm. How were the responses? Were there also some people that didn't get it, or do you also get weird reactions to your project?
So far, there wasn't like hate comments or like more like aggressive reactions to the Gender Cable Manifesto. Probably also because it's very independently produced, but somebody who was way more informed in that field that I raised critical question about, when that person came back to me and proposed, you know, like alternatives that inspired by or at least very relevant to the question that I raised, I find it very meaningful.
And I was interested in what artists or scientists mainly inspire you for your work. Do you have?
Well, if I have to mention a few names, like scholars like Donna Haraway, Annette Singh, who wrote the book The Mushroom at the End of the World. Also like fictional writers, Ursula Le Guin, Octavia Butler, and actually a lot of modernists like who were establishing what we call like design now were very much interested in science themselves, science and technology themselves, like Charles Eames, you know, who people mostly recognize for his famous chair. I mean, not only a famous chair, but famous chairs. At the end of his career, he were, you know, also designing science exhibitions. The famous video, The Power of Ten. Also, Buckminster Fuller, who designed, you know, geodesic domes. He wrote the operation manual for the spaceship Earth. And I think I tend to discover more from the intersection between design and, let's say, like science design and like queer theory.
To not see things in isolation, but always in their context.
Yes.
Becoming a Bat was already an article on future-based for those who didn't read it yet. And you wrote it at the beginning of the COVID-19 outbreak in the Netherlands. Could you maybe explain what the goal of the article was?
So the first month that COVID-19 arrived in Europe, and back then I've been living in a very, very confusing condition, I think, that, you know, in its early arrival in Europe, there was like a surge of racist hate crime that are targeting East Asians, where the virus happened to be originated from. So I was very feeling, in a way, confused and hopeless about the situation back then, about the political situation back then. And so I think I had to write stories to overcome that. I mean, first of all, like, you know, the COVID bat and such are often used as like a racist insult toward Chinese people or East Asian in general. So that I kind of felt the empathy for the bats that are being accused, and which also gave me an idea about the following design project, Money in Vivo, which is an economic science fiction, which starts from a fictional question of which was, what if virus could be used as a form of currency, so that we can value virus as we're valuing money now, by using it as a currency. I mean, COVID-19 had, you know, a tremendous influence on the economy. Like, different countries were dealing with COVID-19 in various ways, involving various economic measures. The COVID measures were as diverse as the economic models that gave me a very natural click to turn not necessarily COVID-19, but virus in general as a currency, and to speculate about different economic models as a way of weaving those non-aligning economic models together. I came up with a context of a talk show in which like different representative from world gathers and discuss about what their economic models are like.
We will post the video if people want to watch the Money in Vivo, which is a very exciting, crazy video, I think. Yeah, this idea of not wanting to see the virus as a bad thing, but maybe incorporating it in our lives, not fighting it anymore. I think it's very amazing that you already had that in the first month of Corona being here. How do you look at the topic almost a year later? I saw that there was also the book for bets that was brought out.
Yes, so I combined the essay and the talk show into a single publication. I'm quite thrilled, like how fast the reality is chasing what I thought to be a fiction. For instance, I think after a month or so from having an idea of using virus as currency, there was a discussion about immune certificate, which is a form of certificate that gives more, you know, economic freedom. If you are, you know, certified to be immune to COVID.
Mm-hmm. And kind of a green passport.
Yes, exactly. And then what I also find interesting is that currency is also a form of certificate, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have like 1 euro bill, then it's a certificate that you own a economic value that is equivalent to 1 euro. So in that regards, like both immune certificate and the idea that I had in the project Money in Vivo, they're leaning toward the same direction, I would say. I mean, this crazy time that we're living in a way, really blurs the boundary between fiction and nonfiction. I think we are living in a very interesting time.
Yeah, we are. It's very blurring between those distinctions you just mentioned. Actually, I wanted to switch to the final project you have been working on, which is also fictional, but a part of it may also be non-fictional, and it's called Hotel Symbiogenesis. Could you explain what Hotel Symbiogenesis is and how the project arose?
So it's a project that started from a critical question on the way we're consuming animal-based fabrics, that we're, you know, so detached from the fact that the materials are driven from the animal that were once alive. Instead of realizing about what those animals actually were, what we do is to wrap it up with narratives on how exotic and scarce those animals are. For instance, like people are talking about, like, you know, how, you know, exotic Kashmir goats are, like how, like in what kind of mountain that they're living in and how scarce they are as a resource, to give it more commercial value, which also reminds me the great exhibition, for instance, that took place, you know, in the 19th century in the colonial setting, where in which, you know, people of color were exhibited as exhibits, as like, you know, exotic exhibits to, you know, to worship the industrial achievement that they were making. So we wanted to deviate from this colonial anthropocentric mythologies that we've been consuming around the animal-derived fabric. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to propose an alternative story. Yeah, I'm saying we because it's a project that is not solely driven by myself. I was a director and I was the main story writer, but there were a lot of amazing crafts people. Yeah, and we're calling ourselves Hypothetical Studios, not Hypothetical Studio, but also with S, because we are not the single initiative, but like a loose collective of individual designs practitioners. Yeah, but nevertheless, we came up with a story which involves many fictional animal species in a fictional island. We wanted to illustrate the animal-human relationship in that island so that the method that we choose was to make furs and leather artifacts that are used by the humans on the fiction island. In the end, that we had fictional hotel room that was filled with the speculative artifacts that are made of, you know, speculative furs and leathers. Yeah, one interesting point that I want to mention here is that we did not use any animal-dried material to craft these speculative first and leathers, because we all agreed upon that it's really pointless to use the products of animal exploitation to construct an alternative story.
Maybe just to make sure for the people who don't know what symbiosis is, how that came together in the garments and objects that you created.
Well, symbiosis means more than one animal species influencing each other, living together and exchanging benefits. And we are incredibly relying on it. Like, even though we are not really realizing, there's an illusion that we are really like independent, but essentially every creature in the planet is relying on the consequences of each other's activity. And this exhibition also was more or less like that, in the sense that, I mean, I call this project a speculative craft, which means in the case of this project, speculation and craft were two symbiotic agents that were driving this project. So my story writing process was pretty much depending on the craft techniques of the collaborators, and also vice versa. Their craft was influenced by what I've been coming up with as a narrative. Yes. So for instance, by learning that ground lichen moss powder can be screen printed on fabric, that gave me like an inspiration for a species of rodents that has sort of photosynthesizing tissue, which is obtained through a symbiotic relationship with plants.
And yeah, this project may be speculative, what could humans do here, create more symbiosis? Mm-hmm. Is there a certain way in your view?
Well, first of all, what I have to emphasize is that we are already more or less a consequence of a multi-species symbiosis. For instance, mitochondria, an organelle that produces ATP, which is a molecule that provides energy for most of the metabolisms that are happening in animal body. It's actually an aerobic bacteria that is embraced by a cell, which was the great ancestor of our cells. I mean, of the cells that composes us, like 1.5 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we are relying on that already. This theory is called symbiogenesis, or endosymbiotic theory, which the exhibition after. Mm-hmm. So my point is that, multi-species symbiosis is not like a futurist science fiction incident that only happens in, in a speculative setting, but it's actually a very banal phenomenon that our lives cannot sustain without. I mean, somehow biology gives more emphasis on the species themselves, that they have like selfish genes that are like, driving them towards an evolutionary direction of survival and growth. Is, I think, one of the modern myths that we have to challenge.
What are your plans in the near future design-wise?
So in the short term, I want to mention the Interspecies Futures exhibition that is happening in New York, that features two of the publications that I edited and designed and independently produced, of course. And in the long term, I just want to be sustainable, that can mean, financial sustainability, or, also that can mean like sustainability of myself as an individual, like, queer person that is, sailing in the binary ocean, or it can be also like, source of creativity that has to be sustainable. But I just want to be sustainable. I want to continue producing what I value on a regular basis.
That's a very beautiful goal. What do you think the future could offer art or design after COVID, and maybe also the other way around?
So while working for Hotel Symbiogenesis project, I had a very eye-opening experience, which was due to travel restrictions. One of our core collective member, who is a Singaporean, couldn't leave her country because, even though she was supposed to work with us in Eindhoven, and it was a big shock to all of us, but as an alternative, she started looking for the initiatives in Singapore that could possibly collaborate with her. And as a happy accident, she found out a local craftspeople there who produced, you know, beautiful woven rattan frames that are exhibited at our exhibition. So my point is, I mean, those kind of international collaboration would never have been possible if, you know, COVID-19 didn't forcibly split it the whole collective globally. So I think what I experienced during this exhibition gave me an impression that the pandemic can provide an opportunity to spread out the hegemony in the art and design industry that is now mostly contained in the Euro-American world.
Either way you look at it, I mean, COVID-19 brings its bad things, but it's also learning us a lesson and creating new ways of, yeah, I don't know, you have to find new ways of working together, Wingen.
Indeed, a surprising accident that nobody could foresee.
I'm happy that it happened that way, because I really like Hotel Symbiosis, and I hope that a lot of more people will look at it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can still access to the virtual exhibition at www.hotel-symbio.com.
Yes, please do. Thank you for sharing everything.
Yes.
Thank you
for having me. Thank you for asking so many relevant questions.
For more information about the work of Noam, show notes and links, please visit futurebased.org.